The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
One of the documents is a lengthy legal explainer. The other one's actually pretty interesting. It goes through the exact paragraphs of this affidavit. The document I'm looking at shows about 78 paragraphs of the affidavit in all, and then lists all the reasons why information should be redacted. However, all of those explanations are in fact redacted.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, heavily redacted documents. Some of the latest developments in the quest for information surrounding the Trump Mar-a-Lago home raid. Pretty unprecedented on a president. Boxes have been retrieved from the former president. And a lot of people have been waiting for today. Actually, they were quite surprised that these documents came back so quickly. They were wondering what they would reveal. As you might know, if you're not up to speed on the story, the president's Florida place, his home down there in Mar-a-Lago, since the beginning of the year contained top secret national defense information, including some derived from confidential human intelligence sources, the FBI was saying. They just released, they searched their home, his home, and they released the affidavit, and it was very heavily redacted. And what's that mean? Lots blacked out. Hard to read it all. In fact, it was so heavily redacted in portions that it's hard to make out what was going on. But this is just to put it in perspective, and I don't want to spend too much time talking about this. So you'll get a lot of coverage of this, I'm sure, in the days ahead as you know your media outlets jump all over the story. The FBI, there's a lot of questions about some of their motives. I have a friend who's in the FBI personally. I went to college with him, so I know there are really good people in the FBI, but you wonder about the upper echelon and some of the things that they sometimes do, and we've seen this with Russian collusion and a whole lot of other things. The FBI determined that it needed to take extraordinary steps to search a former president's home, and that's why they went in. The Wall Street Journal, I was reading an article in a piece they wrote a little bit earlier today. They had previously reported that the Justice Department became concerned that there was additional classified materials at the resort. And this was after months of a negotiation for the return. So they decided to search the premises after at least one person who was very familiar with these documents and surveillance footage appeared to show them, look, they're not properly secured like the president said they were. But again, the president, when this came out, he's calling, hey, release the affidavit. We want to know what's in it, right? And Trump went to his own social platform today, True Social, and he said this. He says, affidavit heavily redacted. Nothing mentioned on nuclear. A total public relations subterfuge by the FBI and the DOJ and our close working relationship regarding the document turnover. We gave them much, end of quote. And, of course, he criticized the judge for allowing the search of his home. 15 boxes were retrieved back in January, just to put some perspective on this. And some of the material in them were identified as classified. I think 14 of them were. They have something like 184 documents with classifications marking. 67 were confidential, 92 were secret, 25 were top secret. So we'll see how this all shakes out. And what will come of it? The fact that the president had those documents there, is it unprecedented? Have other presidents done the same thing? Of course, a lot of presidents have taken other documents home. But something to look at. I don't know how much we're going to learn from these documents, but as experts pore over them, we'll bring you the latest, bring you up to speed on it. Just letting you know a little bit of the history and what's coming out today. There's other news coming from the White House as well. The Department of Homeland Security is officially terminated plans for their disinformation board. Remember that? I don't know if you remember this whole thing, but boy, did it get a lot of people up. I mean, who's going to head up the disinformation board? It was a woman named Nina Jankowicz, who previously served as a disinformation fellow at Wilson Center. She was supposed to head up the board as the executive director, and she really she came to fame, if you will. People all well, saw her performance. I don't know if you remember it. Here's a little bit of Nina Jankowicz. She was going to be the potential disinformation czar, singing Mary Poppins' disinformation song. Remember this?
It's how how you hide a little, hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little, hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little lie. When Rudy Giuliani shared bad intel from Ukraine. Or when TikTok influencers say COVID can cause pain. They're laundering disinfo and we really should take note. And not support their lies with our wallet, voice or vote. Oh, information laundering is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious. By saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet so disinformation's origin seems likely less atrocious.
There you go. I'm sure you remember that. Maggie said to me, Maggie, you can open your mic. That song's been stuck in your head ever since you pulled that audio.
Ugh. Okay. I clipped that earlier.
Sorry about
and
that.
I've been just like,
yeah, I mean, I felt bad for the girl. I mean, how humiliating. I mean, she thought it was great. She can certainly sing, I guess. But boy, that's the head of the disinformation service. The announcement today, of course, concludes really what is a long and ill-fated struggle to get the board off the ground. And there was just overwhelming backlash. I think part of it was this. I mean, this really was on the radar of a lot of people. And this whole disinformation board was just met with complete skepticism. I mean, from lawmakers, to be fair, on both sides of the aisle. Of course, the White House defended the DHS board. You know, they said this is about free speech concerns, you know, saying it was objective. It's supposed to prevent disinformation in a range of communities. You know, I get concerned when people want to censor what we see. We saw that with Hunter Biden's laptop. We've seen that with the Russia collusion. We see a lot of that type of news. So, you know, the media, if they did their job, they should be that filter for us in some respects. The media is supposed to be the watchdog of the government. It really should be. Unfortunately, television news today is no longer objective, unbiased, or balanced. It is it's filtered, and it's partisan. And I think that that does everyone a disservice. It makes the country, I think, a weaker place, unfortunately. We got to get that right. On other news, Pope Benedict, did you hear about this? Some church news that you may not hear some other places. You'll hear a lot about those other stories. Father Federico Lombardi, he was the director of the Vatican Press Office. Oh, I think his last year was 2016. I think he served about 10 years there. He did an interview this week, and he said something that has people wondering. He said that Pope Emeritus, Benedict XVI, he says he's ready for a definitive encounter with God. And just to put that in perspective, the Pope Benedict, or Emeritus, if you will, he's up there. He's 95 years of age. He turned 95 in April, so he's a little bit over that. They say he has great clarity. He's dedicated his life to prayer. He's a man, despite his fragility, communicates serenity, and he says, I think it's due to this intense prayer life that he has. I'll give you a quick flashback. Let's go back in time. The history was made. And you talk about relevant radio, too, and the things that we were there for. You know, I joined the network back in 2004, and I've been here ever since. And we've covered, you know, the deaths of popes and historic moments in the church, like consecrations and the election of presidents. But the top of the list, one of the most unique things I think I've ever had to cover, something that had not taken place for centuries, was a resignation of a pope. Here's a look back at that historic resignation, a little bit from George Stephanopoulos reporting from Rome about 9 years ago. Listen.
It's a moment weighted with emotion and history. The first pope to resign in almost 600 years. And yesterday, the pope, in his final public remarks, spoke in remarkably personal terms about the joys and burdens of being pope. A thank you from the cardinals for the pope they chose 8 years ago. You see Dean Sedano hugging the pope right there. I'm joined here by Father John Walk, a Vatican expert who teaches the Pontifical University of Holy Cross here in Rome. You saw Dean Sedano talk about the mystery going on here and also the history. Every cardinal in that room is aware of how historic this decision by the Pope is.
Every transfer of authority in the life of the church is a historic moment, but we're living through truly an amazing and unique moment and the life of the Catholic Church right now.
The Pope speaking now. Let's listen again.
It was a joy to walk with you over the past few years in the light of the presence of the Lord. As I said yesterday, before thousands of faithful who filled St. Peter's Square, your proximity, your advice were of great help in my ministry. During the past 8 years, we lived with faith very beautiful moments of radiant light in the church, together with also some clouds in the sky. We tried to serve Christ and His church with deep and total love, which is the soul of our ministry. We gave hope, which comes from Christ, who is the only one who can enlighten our path. We can thank the Lord who allowed us to grow in the communion, and together we pray Him to help you to grow even more in this profound unity, so that the Collegium of Cardinals is like an orchestra where the diversity of the expressions of the Universal Church may become one in harmony.
That was, of course, Pope Francis 9 years ago. He's now, as I said, in his 90th, Pope Benedict, I should say. He's now in his 95th year. Pope Francis, there's speculation that he may somehow step down too. He made an announcement that he plans to visit the central Italian city of L'Aquila and its basilica there. And why is that significant? Well, there's speculation that he might soon announce his own resignation. He's, by the way, firmly denied this. I want to be clear on that. But again, people are wondering. L'Aquila's basilica, just to give you a little historical perspective, it's the burial place of St. Celestine V. Why is that significant? Well, he issued a decree declaring the right of a pope to voluntarily resign. And then he did so in 1294. A historic moment in the church then. And, of course, whoever thought we'd see it again? Of course, Pope Benedict did that. It was also there, on top of Pope Celestine's glass casket, that Pope Benedict left this woolen pallium that he wore during his installation. And that was a gesture many people had been assigned of his resignation to come 4 years later. So he goes there, he takes his pallium, he leaves it there. 4 years later, he announces he's stepping down. I am sure over those 48 months, he was praying about what he should do, how significant this would be, who would be his successor, you know, and he made what was, again, a historic decision. So what are we seeing now? Pope Francis visiting that Italian city, going to the same area. Coincidence, or is it a portent of things to come? You know, Pope Francis, he raised the possibility of retiring due to his declining health. And just, again, he's denying it. And who knows what's going to happen with him, right? I mean, it would be unprecedented to have two Pope Emerituses, right? I mean, how does that work, right? But this weekend, just to give you some perspective, Pope Francis is going to create 20 new cardinals this Saturday. He is going to create 20 new cardinals, many of whom one day will choose his successor. When he dies, the College of Cardinals will go into conclave, and Holy Spirit will be at work, and we'll have a new pope. Maybe we'll see another one soon. Maybe it'll be many years, and pray to God. This is the eighth consistory since Francis was elected in 2013. It's being particularly closely watched for signs of the kind of Catholic Church that many think Francis is trying to shape. Cardinals include men for their progressive views and their pastoral work, and they come from all over the world, Brazil to Nigeria to India to Singapore to East Timor. So Saturday swearing in at St. Peter's is going to join a two-day meeting of cardinals starting on Monday, and maybe I'll bring you up to speed a little bit more on that. But Pope Francis has canceled a lot of events in recent months. He's been forced to use a wheelchair due to knee pain, and the door is open to him stepping down. So I would just ask you, pray for him, you know, pray for his health, pray for the church. I know we don't often think the church needs prayers, or the Pope certainly needs prayers, but he does. He probably needs it more than anything else. And of course, let's pray for Pope Benedict the 16th as well, as he continues to climb in age. Final note just on this, something I had seen a little bit earlier, which I think is really telling. Pope Francis, just to give you a perspective of the College of Cardinals, he'll have chosen 90 cardinals out of the 132 cardinals that are eligible to elect a new pope. That's about two-thirds of the total. So that's pretty significant. And I think the could reflect his vision for where he sees the church going and where he is ultimately leading it. So we'll see. I just bring that up to speed. Let's pray for our church. Let's pray for our country. Let's pray for each other. The chaplet's coming up. We're going to be talking about antidepressants in a minute. So if your kids are on it, you're going to want to listen to this. Before I do that, though, Maggie and I were talking about a conversion. You talk about praying for the grace of conversion. I had just, there's a Padre Pio movie coming out. And Padre Pio is one of my favorite saints. He's this priest who bore the wounds of Christ. He had the stigmata. He could be in two locations at once. He could bilocate. He could levitate off the ground. He read souls. He prophesied. He was just in a power. He was a giant amongst so many of these different saints, just in terms of these preternatural gifts that he had. Well, the actor that was playing him had an unbelievable experience. And Maggie, you just put this on my radar. Why don't you fill everyone in with Shia LaBeouf? Is that how you say LaBeouf or LaBeouf?
I think it's LaBeouf.
LaBeouf. LaBeouf. It looks French. B-E-O-U-F. LaBeouf. You know, LaBeouf. I understand he's converting to Catholicism.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, it's a fascinating episode if you watch this clip with Bishop Barron that was released yesterday. Shia had been in a point of his life where he was broken. He wasn't even speaking to family. He was embroiled in a lot of controversy. He was clearly in some kind of recovery program. He was brought to this point where really he had nothing but to try the Lord. And he had been given this offer to pursue this character, Padre Pio, who he knew nothing about. He had only known how to make fun of Catholicism. And so he tells the story of this amazing journey of getting to know some friars who really walk him through this whole journey, and he has a radical conversion. So I clipped a couple pieces here I thought might be interesting.
Love it.
He had never read the Bible before. And the first brother that he befriends at this friary says, well, you got to start with the gospel. So here we go.
And I'm falling into a group of men that met me in San Lorenzo, namely a guy named Brother Jude, who starts talking to me about the gospel. And he says, well, if you're going to play Pio, you need to read the gospel. And so I'd never read the gospel, and he's reading Matthew to me.
So you'd never read, like, the gospel of Matthew straight
Nothing.
Through?
Yeah, okay. I've read all Sam Harris. I've watched all the TED Talks.
Yeah, right.
And was really good at attacking Catholicism because it made me feel superior.
Kind of agnostic / atheist at the time.
Yes. I'd like to argue. Because it made me feel like I was in power.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I'd like to be contrarian, which I find most secular people enjoy, the control of it.
Yeah. So now you're up at San Lorenzo, and you're given the Gospel of Matthew.
I'm reading Matthew.
You're reading it for the first time.
I read it for the first time, and things start to strike me.
Like
John the Baptist, being a Reformed hedonist, being this man who's wearing like this who was sort of like, you know, scraggly and like kind of felt like an old Western character.
Eating locust and wearing
he felt like kind of rustic and strong and masculine. And my opinion of Christ at this point felt almost like I was reading about a Buddhist, like this very soft, fragile, all loving, all listening, but no ferocity, no romance.
Then you hadn't read the gospel.
Hadn't read the gospel
at that point.
I just had this art that I had seen of like this very soft,
more feminized
Jesus. Yes. So all I knew about was this very soft, meek Jesus, which didn't fit into my idea of what masculinity would be. And then I read about John the Baptist, and it became quite appealing, his grizzle.
Yeah, right.
And then you get further into the gospel, and you start getting into, like, I started reading about a route. I started, like, reading a map, like, towards something that felt like let go. That's really what I got out of the gospels. If I could wrap it up in two words, it was let go. And at that time when I was reading it, I was holding on so tight to a life that I was slipping away through my hands, to a 35 years of management, that the gospel gave me this this invite to just let go.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Powerful stuff. Maggie, I'm sitting here and thinking, well, how can you not be converted when you dive into the life of not just John the Baptist, but of Padre Pio as well? It's amazing.
It is incredible. And he goes a little bit further about halfway through the interview, talking about how different people start teaching him prayers and challenge him on meditation. And eventually then he is able to start receiving the Eucharist because he's been catechized at this point. And so I think maybe just time for one more clip here that illustrates that part of the journey for him. And I found it very compelling. So here we go.
Now I'm experiencing prayer. I'm experiencing rosary. I'm starting to learn Mass really well. I'm starting to be a part of Mass. I'm starting to feel the effect of Mass. I'm not receiving the host yet because we weren't sure if I was baptized or not. And so I couldn't receive yet, and I felt this deep longing. I didn't know I was baptized. I had been baptized earlier in my life and didn't even remember it.
Yeah.
My uncle had baptized me in
Trinitarian formula?
Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
And so then we found out that I could receive Mass and started receiving Mass, and I start feeling like this deep reprieve. It's not just like a cracker anymore. I start feeling like a physical effect from it. I start feeling a reprieve, and it starts feeling like regenerative, and I start enjoying it to such a degree I don't want to miss it ever. And then I start going to other Masses in different parts of the city. I wind up at San Lorenzo. Doing Liturgy of the Hours with them, which feels like a bigger version of what I'm experiencing in Santa Ynez at Mass. I'm feeling safety, which is really what I'm chasing, like this safety.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I love it, Meg. That's good. I'm glad you pulled that audio. I didn't know that, but maybe we'll invite him on to tell a story in greater detail. And I'm looking forward to the movie. When's that film coming out? Do you know when Padre Pio is going to be released?
It sounded like from the clip yesterday that they had screened it with the Capuchins that he's worked with. Oh. And so they're starting there. I'm not sure when the actual release date is, though.
Well, you heard me talk about it on the air a lot. You really want a great film. I've yet to see it. I'm going to hopefully get a sneak peek at it. It's something you're certainly going to see. Dr. Leonard Sachs is going to be joining me in a second. He's been holding on for a second. Dr. Sachs, thanks for your patience. Let me take a quick pause here. When we come back, I want to pick it up on antidepressants. I don't know if you're on them right now or if your children are on antidepressants. I don't know if you remember what happened with Tom Cruise. It was years ago now. I think it was back in 2005 when he was at the height of his fame and Matt Lauer was still on the air. I'll tell you what went down there, and we'll take a look at antidepressants and your children as well. Should your kids be taking these? If you got a question or comment, you can join us as well. We'll be right back.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
All the news and issues
now
that are happening now.
One place.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Now.
Hey, thanks for joining me. Chapel's about 30 minutes away. You know, it's not often that, I go back in time and I look at somebody like Tom Cruise who, had these controversial comments back in 2005. He was with Matt Lauer. And, of course, Matt Lauer's, he's no longer with NBC. He's been outed as a sexual predator. But remember when Cruise went on the Today Show with him and they had this big conversation between the two, and it turned very awkward because Cruise started to criticize use of antidepressants. And at one point saying, look, there's no such thing as chemical imbalance in your body. And this was about 20 years ago now, I guess, almost 18, 17 years. Was Cruise wrong or was he right? He went against the medical establishment, took a lot of heat for it. The controversy, took place around, I guess it was Brooke Shields at the time. She had the birth of her daughter, and she was struggling, and she returned from the hospital with her baby, and things took a turn for the worse mentally, and I think she took some antidepressants, and Cruise called her out on it. What's the truth? Are these SSRIs, Are they good? Are they, or are they mind-altering drugs? Who should take them? Should our kids be exposed to these at all? A couple of questions there to look at, and we're going to be joined by Dr. Leonard Sachs on that. Here's just a quick look back at that infamous interview a decade ago. Listen to this.
Whether it was the antidepressant or going to a counselor or a psychiatrist, isn't that enough?
Matt, you have to understand this. Here we are today, where I talk out against drugs and psychiatric abuses of electric shocking people, okay, against their will, of drugging children with them not knowing the effects of these drugs. Do you know what Adderall is? Do you know Ritalin? Do you know now that Ritalin is a street drug? Do you understand that?
The difference is
Matt, I'm asking you a question.
I understand there's abuse of all of these things.
No, you see, here's the problem. You don't know the history of psychiatry. I do.
Aren't there examples, and might not Brooke Shields be an example of someone who benefited from one of those drugs?
All it does is mask the problem, Matt. And if you understand the history of it, it masks the problem. That's what it does. That's all it does. You're not getting to the reason why.
So let's talk about it. I think this is really interesting. Dr. Leonard Sachs, who's a very gifted physician and a psychologist from Pennsylvania, authored a number of different books. He's written about this many times over the years. I went back and I've seen his writings from as far back as 2012 on this. He joins us today to give us a perspective, better understanding of whether these help or they hurt, what age you should take them, whether or not your children should take them. And if you got a question or a comment, you can join us too. 888-914-9149. Doctor, welcome. Thank you for your patience today. Appreciate you waiting so long.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you heard Matt Lauer. That was a flashback, of course.
Yeah.
Time. People thought he was crazy. What have we learned over the past decade and a half? Is there
what we've learned over the last month is really the story here. Because 1 month ago, researchers in England released or published their analysis. They wanted to look at what is the evidence for the claim that depression is due to a chemical imbalance, and specifically to low serotonin levels. And they reviewed every relevant paper on this topic, looking at levels of serotonin metabolites, levels of the serotonin transporter gene, genetic studies. They looked at this question from every possible angle and looking at all of the studies that have been published over the last 30 years, they concluded that there is no evidence that depression in humans is associated with a low level of serotonin or is caused by a low level of serotonin.
Wow.
Now, it's important to understand what they were not saying. They were not saying that medications like Lexapro and Zoloft are not effective. This was not a study of the effectiveness of antidepressants. It was a study specifically of whether depression is due to a chemical imbalance, and they concluded that the answer is no. And this was studied, it was published in a journal called Molecular Psychiatry, and any of your listeners can pull it up at the full text at no charge. Just Google Serotonin Theory of Depression, Molecular Psychiatry. It'll pop up as the first link guaranteed because it's had over 600,000 views in the last month, which I can tell you as a researcher is a huge number for a scholarly article. It might not be much for a YouTube video, but for a scholarly article published in a peer-reviewed medical journal, 600,000 views in a month is off the charts because it's been read by many journalists, has been written about. You mentioned an article in EV Magazine. It's been written about in Salon. It's been written about everywhere because this notion that depression is due to a chemical imbalance and specifically to low serotonin levels has really become like a cultural meme and not really questioned. And it appears not to be accurate.
You know what I find striking about that? I was reading a little bit about this before you came on, this whole chemical imbalance theory. We should talk about that. It came from a psychiatrist at Harvard back in 1965, of course, being very popular, not only in the scientific realm, but with the general public. And it seemed to, I don't know, seamlessly answer a lot of questions that people had about why people were depressed. One researcher called it a marketing myth. The fact that chemical imbalances take place, they do, but that's an oversimplification of what depression is caused by. Your take on that? Are there any cases where somebody's chemical balance is out of whack that can affect their psyche?
Well, without doubt, I've seen many cases as a clinician where you put someone on medication and the medication is very helpful. As I mentioned a moment ago, these researchers are not saying the medications don't help. They were just questioning whether our mythology of how they work is accurate. And this is not unique to depression. I can tell you as a physician and a psychologist that there's also the dopamine theory of schizophrenia, which is that schizophrenia reflects imbalance in the levels of dopamine, and antipsychotics work to restore normal levels of dopamine. And many people have pointed out that the drug industry, the pharmaceutical industry, has really seized on this because it makes their medications so logical. If depression is due to low serotonin and medications like Lexapro, Celexa, and Zoloft appear to boost serotonin levels, then everything's great. And you're depressed, let's go ahead and take this antidepressant. The reality, though, is that humans are more complicated. And mood cannot be reduced to a single chemical or even a handful of chemicals. We're more complicated than that. And that's the truth that I think the researchers are, if you read the interviews with them over the last month, I think they're trying to wake us up that the human mind is more than a mix of chemicals, that it's more complicated than that. And yeah, there's been a rise in depression over the last 20 years. That's probably not because we're all just suddenly developing chemical imbalances. There are other reasons that I think are grounded in culture and experience that help to explain that rise in depression.
My guest, Dr. Leonard Sachs, if you want to join us, you got a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. Feel free to go ahead and dial in. Maggie just got a tweet. Let me share this with you. I don't know who tweeted what the name was, but she says, I tried SSRIs on my daughter post-lockdown. It was an absolute disaster. Her filters were gone. She got very aggressive and angry. And this mother says, never again, never again. Is there an age where they work better? Should kids be on these things? What about this mother who wanted to help her child and had this type of reaction? Is it the dosage? There's a lot of questions there. There's some parents saying, oh, my kid needs it. This mother had a terrible reaction to it.
Well, I wrote a book called The Collapse of Parenting. And in that, the original title of that book was The Collapse of American Parenting. And the subtitle was Why Most Kids Would Now Be Better Off Raised Outside the United States. And the point I made there, and the publisher didn't let me keep the title, but they did let me keep that a key chapter where I compared the rate of prescribing of psychiatric medications for kids in the United States compared with kids outside the United States. So an American kid is 14 times more likely to be on medication for ADHD compared to a kid in the United Kingdom. An American kid is 40 times more likely to be on medication for bipolar disorder compared to a kid in Germany. An American kid is 93 times more likely, not 93%, but 93 times, that's 9,300% more likely to be on medications like Risperdal, Seroquel, and Zyprexa compared to a kid in Italy. American kids are now many times more likely to be medicated for psychiatric disorders compared to kids outside of North America. That wasn't true 40 years ago. 40 years ago, American kids were no more likely to be on medications compared to kids in England or Germany or Italy. Now American kids are many times more likely to be on medication. And so the question I'm raising in that chapter is why? What's gone wrong with American parenting that American kids are now 10, 20, 50 times more likely to be diagnosed with psychiatric disorders compared with kids in England or Scotland or Germany or Italy? Yeah. And I try to answer that question, and it has nothing to do with chemical imbalances.
So what's the answer? I'm sitting back here, and you know, I know we took God out of society. That certainly has a ramification. We have chosen to medicate our kids. The family's in crisis right now. There's a breakdown in that. That collateral damage affects kids. What's the reason, Doctor? Why are we medicating our kids?
There's more than one answer, but one of the key answers, I think, has to do with American culture.
Yeah.
And you and I talked about this just a few days ago. Yeah. But back in this, and this again is not a guess or nostalgia. We've got people who study American culture, and referring to a group at UCLA who looked at the most popular TV shows in this country in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and then in the 2000s and 2010s. And they found in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, the most popular TV shows that teens were watching were consistently teaching kids that what's important is to do the right thing, to tell the truth, even if it hurts, to be a good friend. But they found that today that's not true, that the most popular TV shows now prioritize being famous, winning, American Idol, The Voice. It's all about winning and becoming famous, you know, doing the right thing. That's going to get you voted off the island. You know, any human, if they try, can do the right thing, can tell the truth. That is within your grief, and that is within your grasp. But it's not within your grasp to be rich and famous. You can try as hard as you want. And I can tell you as a family doctor that I see these girls who are like, wow, if I work really hard on my TikTok video, I'll be the next JoJo Siwa. I'll be rich and famous. And it doesn't happen. And if the culture is teaching you that the most important thing is to be rich and famous, and you're not, then you're a loser. American culture now sets up kids to feel like losers, to feel like life is hopeless. And so we've got an explosion in anxiety and depression among American teens. I'm not saying that's the whole story, but I do think that's a big part of it.
My guest today, Dr. Leonard Sachs. Let's grab a quick call or two for you here. Let's start with Roman in Naperville, Illinois. Hi, Roman. Good afternoon.
Hey, Drew. Yeah, I've been dealing with bipolar 1 disorder, manic depression for 30 years. And there's definitely been an uptick in antidepressant and anti-anxiety medication. It's almost like the antibiotics, how they overuse them. Mm-hmm. And the other comment I wanted to make is that there's no pill or counseling that will cure guilty conscience. And only the church can help you with that.
Amen. That's the beauty of reconciliation, the sacrament of reconciliation, healing sacrament. And I think that would do a lot of people good. I think that's another thing. We've abandoned God. We've embraced sin, and we continue to avoid getting right with God through that particular sacrament. Doctor, let's talk about that, too. Are these overprescribed right now? I know that a lot of teenagers have difficulty concentrating, and I often think about this. Like, when I was in college, you know, you do these all-nighters. So what happens? A kid is not doing great in school. In fact, I know a couple of people like this. The doctor's consulted. The teenager doesn't necessarily meet the criteria for ADHD. But the doctor says, why not try Adderall? Let's see whether or not that helps.
Let's try it and see if it helps.
And then the student reports more energy, improved ability to concentrate. They're happier. Everybody's pleased. And people think, what's not to like? And now this is the drug of choice in colleges and universities across the country. People want to study. They want to do better. They're getting these Adderall prescriptions. Your thoughts?
So let me tell you a story about that. So I was invited to speak at a conference at Harvard University, and the topic was learning and the brain. And I wish I could tell you that my talk was the buzz of the conference. My talk was on gender and education, but it wasn't. Yeah. The talk that everybody was really excited about was an MIT professor, Dr. John Gabrielli, somehow got permission to give Adderall to normal kids and to withhold medication from kids with severe ADD. And then to compare how well kids learned in each group. And he found that Adderall helps normal kids more than it helps kids with ADHD. And that's hugely important because so many times I've said to parents, I've said, hey, your son doesn't meet criteria for ADHD. And the parents have said, well, yeah, but the other doctor gave him Adderall or Vyvanse. It was really helping. It really made a difference. The doctor, the parent, is using the response to medication as though that response to medication had some diagnostic significance. Adderall was prescribed for ADHD. It really helped our kid. Therefore, our kid must have ADHD. Bzz, wrong, not true. These medications help normal kids as much or more than they help kids with ADHD. Well, as you said, what's not to like? Why not just put all the kids on ADHD? Well, the concern is we now have many studies, which I cite again, actually in Boys Adrift, showing that these medications damage the motivational center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens. And I, again, in my own practice, I've seen so many. So I'll tell you one family, mom confronted her son and she said, you know, what's the story? You wake up late every day. You work a few hours a week at the coffee shop. You're 27 years old. You don't have a life. And she insisted he come see me. He was on these medications throughout childhood and adolescence prescribed by another doctor. He's happy. He's having a great time with his pornography and his video games. Yeah. His mom pulling his hair out, but he's perfectly content. That's the downside. These medications are dangerous. It can be dangerous. Now, again, I want to put in the disclaimer, stop any medication without consulting your physician. Mm-hmm. But again, American doctors often don't understand the dangers. And that's another factor driving this overprescribing. So, yeah, I think medications are clearly overprescribed. I mean, when you look at the fact that a kid in England is 10 times more likely to be on medications for ADHD, 14 times more likely than a kid in the United States, is that because English doctors are underdiagnosing ADHD? I don't think so. Actually, England's kind of an outlier. I wrote a book for a French publisher, working with French colleagues, I learned that in all of France, there are fewer than 6,000 kids on medication for ADHD. Wow. In all of France, there are more kids in Omaha, Nebraska, on medication for ADHD than in all of France.
That's wild. Let's pick it up on that when we come back, too. I have to take a short pause here. When we come back, love to hear why. What's it about France? Why are there less in France than all of Nebraska? And we'll take your calls. I only have about 10 minutes with Dr. Sachs. If you have a question, a comment, you want to get into the conversation, I will go to the phones. I'll open them now at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Taking a look at antidepressants. It's a prescription for children and adults. And where we are, don't go away.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Pray, hope, and don't worry. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Coming up next.
It's great to be with you today. Thank you for joining me. You know, we've been looking at the rising rates of anxiety in our kids, the rising levels of depression, the suicide rate, suicidal ideation through the roof. What's causing this? Now, there's been a major approach to it, and those are antidepressants. That's what we're looking at today. How safe are they for our children, how safe are they for you if you are on them? And do they do damage? That's really the big question. My guest today, Dr. Leonard Sachs, gifted psychologist and physician, author of a number of books. You might want to check out The Collapse of Parenting. You can check out, of course, Why Gender Matters, Boys Adrift or Girls on the Edge, a couple of his other books, all at LeonardSachs.com. LeonardSachs.com. He joins us today. And Dr. Let's jump right into the phones because I know time's going to fly here pretty quickly. Martha is listening in Arizona. A lot of people want to get in on this with you. Martha, thanks for calling. Good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call. I have been on Paxil, 10 milligrams, for at least 20 years. I don't want to be on it anymore. I have tried everything to get off it. I have terrible withdrawal symptoms, which is popular with serotonin uptake med. So right. I just want to know what his advice would be.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So she's making a real good point, which is that once you get on these medications, it can be very difficult to get off. And Paxil is famous among physicians for being really the hardest or among the very hardest to stop. And my short suggestion would be work with your doctor, taper over many months. 10 to 7.5 for a month or two, 5 for a month or two. It is difficult. And the withdrawal symptoms can be worse than the disease. They're weird and scary. And again, how many patients are really counseled by their doctor? Patient comes in, they're not feeling happy, they're not living their best life. The doctor says, well, try an antidepressant, let's see if it helps. Very seldom does the doctor say, and once you've taken this thing, you may find it very difficult to stop. And I think it's, again, one of the unique things about the United States is that in this country, drug companies are allowed to market direct to consumer. Your magazine comes wrapped in an ad for Lexapro. These ads pop up online. That's unlawful outside of the United States, with the exception of New Zealand. No other country allows that. And the drug companies are very deceptive in promoting these medications as safe, effective, no downside. Very so, and when they do read the downsides, it's in fine print or on the TV commercials rattled off while the mother's hugging her son, etc. So we've got a real problem with the pharmaceutical industry in this country.
Xanax, another popular drug, right? Does that fall into the same category? Are they hard to get off of once people start taking those? And what about Xanax?
Xanax is a totally different category. That's benzodiazepines. Those are scheduled. And so because they're scheduled medications, doctors actually are pretty good about warning people that these medications are highly addictive. I don't see doctors abusing Xanax the way that they overprescribe medications like Lexapro and Paxil.
That's well said. Let's go to the phones. Interesting call out of Escondido. Is that right, Escondido, California? Rachel, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm actually a school psychologist. I have a friend that has been on ADD, ADHD medication since she was probably in junior high school. She's almost 40 years old, and I know the doctor was saying that, it destroys the motivation portion of the brain, and I mean, she's a really good example of that. Like she's maybe had a job once or twice in all the years that I've known her. And I'm just wondering, and she likes to sleep all day. And I'm just wondering, I mean, what can you do? What can be done? Yeah. When they've been on this for so long, what can we do for them?
Yeah, that's the email or the phone call I dread the most is when the parent, I get an email and the parent says, my son's not working, not looking for work, spends his time playing video games. He's 32 years old. What can I do? The short answer from a medical perspective is I got nothing. There is no medication. There is no medical intervention that is of any proven effectiveness. And as I said, I got nothing. So I have to refer that patient for spiritual counseling to mend the hole in their soul that to help them to get in touch with their humanity again. And this is an area where I think modern psychiatry is very weak. The recognition that we are not just bundles of chemicals, that we have souls, that we are spiritual beings. And when someone has nothing in their heart, there's a big hole where the soul is supposed to be. There's no medication that's going to fix that.
Wow. Doctor, I'm always delighted to have you here with me. I only have a couple of minutes. We'll take a few more calls while we can. My apologies to everyone who's on hold. I'll do my best to get you on. Mary in Minneapolis, good afternoon.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. I have experienced something in our family about the same idea with those drugs and have found a lot of help in dietary protocols. I know the doctor mentioned it was 40, 50 years ago. It seemed people are getting more and more on this. Well, what happened about 50 years ago is our diets changed here in the United States. And in our own personal experience, family member had been a little obese and was, anyway, he was put on those drugs that the doctor mentioned. And then I experienced something, and we had to go on this diet, and it was a gut-restoring diet.
Yeah.
And it got such good results that he's been off the serotonin for 2 years, cut back, way back on the other. Of course, we did taper off, like the doctor was talking about. But I really believe that this is a really godsend.
Well, Mary, I love your point. We only have a minute left. I want to give the doctor the final points. So let me just follow up with that. First of all, congratulations. Doctor, the gut biome she talks about, restoring that. There has been other physicians I spoke to who think that's really important and it's cutting edge science. But to her other point, diet, exercise, sleep, your environment, what role do they play? Do we need a more comprehensive approach to dealing with this?
Well, sure. And in so many ways, I think our whole culture has pushed people to look for a pill to fix their problem, a pill to feel better, a pill to lose weight. And I think in many ways we need to recognize, look, you've got to take responsibility for your life. You've got to eat right. You've got to get a good night's sleep. You've got to turn off the screens. You got to take responsibility. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, that we need to look at the big picture and not just try to look for a pill to fix our problems.
All right. Well, doctor, thank you for your time. I am grateful for it. It's always a joy to talk with you. Best way to connect is what, Dr. Leonard Sachs?
LeonardSachs.com.
LeonardSachs.com, and your books are available there. I'm assuming on Amazon as well. Hey, we'll catch up again soon. Thank you for your insight, okay? Appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me.
That's Dr. Leonard Sachs. I have to take a short pause. News and headlines are straight ahead. The chaplet will follow.